You talked in our last segment about the laws passed to protect wild salmon going 300 years ago on this continent alone, going back to 1709. Regionally, the Northwest Power Planning Council was an effort. The Endangered Species Act, which is a federal act, is hopefully going to prevent the extinction of several species, which have been put on that list. But for some reason, there's a way to get around all of these laws. Can you talk about maybe these two specifically, Northwest Power Planning Council or the Endangered Species Act?
Well, the odd thing about the Northwest Power Planning Council and about just sort of the Columbia dams in particular, there's been court cases and directives to sort of prioritize protection of salmon, at least co-equal with power production, for I think a couple decades now. And the decisions that are made under those directives still sort of relatively uniformly favor power production and can result in decisions like the idea that the best available science for getting salmon around dams is to put them in trucks and drive them around. Now, maybe as a geologist, I've got the privilege of long-term vision, but it's hard for me to imagine native salmon runs actually running around in trucks as a sort of a viable long-term mechanism for protecting the runs.
Well, we'll give a break to the environmentalists. We'll make them carpool.
There we go. Put a lot of them in each truck. That'll work.
But that's the mentality. Drive them around.
Yeah, which is really more of, it's not really a solution. It's addressing the symptoms, not the cause. The problem is that the Columbia has been turned into a series of lakes. And how you could actually get fish down it
hasn't really been addressed
and was never addressed, even though the problem was brought up during planning.
The notion of the Columbia, talking about breaching the dams, talking about taking them down, very, very controversial. And you have to look, and you yourself point out in the book the good that having those dams helped us win World War II, helped create a whole breadbasket in eastern Washington. So maybe you can speak to that, but ultimately to the notion that this is, and you say it yourself in the book, an entitlement.
Yeah, the history of the economic development of the Northwest, particularly from the 30s through the 50s, is wrapped up in power and in dams. You can argue about whether the societal decision to sort of trade off salmon runs for the productivity that the dams brought was deliberate or incidental, managed, mismanaged, however you look at it. There was an upside to it. What I think is actually really telling now about the discussions on what to do in the Columbia, and not just on the Columbia, because you can make similar arguments about the Puget Sound, the Willamette Valley, other places where we've changed the landscape in order to develop the region along our economic model, or the lines of our economic models. We've been very successful at it. And now that we have been, and that we're one of the more wealthy regions of the wealthiest, arguably one of the wealthiest countries in the history of the world, whether we will choose to actually undo or to mitigate, or to back off a bit on things that would allow us to recover some of our natural resources, our self-reproducing natural resources that we like to eat, like salmon, whether we're willing to make that choice and do the things that it will take to do it is something that I think transcends just, you know, the dams in the Columbia or some of the valley bottoms of the Northwest. It's a major long-term cultural question that we have to wrestle with, and not just on economic grounds.
Well, let's take one of those, for example, the Elwha Dams, two of them in the Olympic National Park, voted and approved to be taken down during the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, spent the entire Clinton administration being fought for one reason or another. To this day, even though they were built with no real power market at the time.
And they were illegal when they were built.
And illegal. Did we mention they're illegal, too? Still can't take them down.
That's been... I've been hearing about the plans to take down the Elwha Dam since I moved to Washington in 1991. And being someone who studies rivers, I mean, it's one of the best natural experiments from a purely intellectual viewpoint that one could do. This river's been dammed for a while. There's a lot of sediment behind it. What will happen when you take the dam out? I've been amazed at the pace at which nothing's happened. it's been very politically very difficult. And I think the real reason behind that, to put on a non-scientific pop psych analyst hat.
I know where you're going with this. Take down those dams and you're going after the
first
Columbia
domino. Exactly. Right. And I think the political fear that it was the first domino, even though the Elwha dams really serve little to no purpose and haven't for quite a long time, that they are a domino. But there's dams on the East Coast. The Penobscot one just came down in conjunction with a power company. There's places that are realizing that, you know, we can, by undoing some blockages and dams and opening up some salmon habitat, maybe that will let people use another part of it for other things. The Columbia is kind of a special problem because it's such a huge problem, but there's an awful lot of obsolete dams that are coming down in other places. So the whole rationale of the Elwha as the first domino, I think, is kind of moot, and yet still it hasn't come down.
Yeah. You use the term genetic integrity to describe one of the looming crises with salmon, and this is where we get into genetic engineering and domesticating salmon and the problems in saying science to the rescue regarding this. Tell us about the term genetic integrity.
Well, the idea with genetic integrity is that if you have a lot of, say, farm fish that are escaping out into the wild, or you have hatchery fish that are released intentionally into the wild, and you're worried about native populations of wild fish, if they crossbreed, you're essentially diluting the genetic integrity of the wild fish by introducing sort of fish that were not selected for, that haven't gone through the rigors of nature to actually be adapted to their local stream. And so you could call it genetic integrity. It would be the thing that genetic pollution would be working against. And those concepts are kind of odd when they're used in sort of a context, I think, other than the idea of something that is well adapted to a particular place. Like, the idea applied to people makes no sense. We've taken over the whole planet. The idea of having specialized runs of people is ludicrous. But for salmon, they're adapted to their river. And that's why they've been successful in those rivers. And that's why, if you take a run, say, a lot of the earliest efforts at hatchery reintroductions were to take Chinook salmon from the Sacramento River in California and take them out to Maine in the 1890s and 1880s to try and recover Maine salmon. Problem is, they were a different species, and the California salmon just, they didn't work in Maine. There were at least millions of fish into the ocean. None of them ever came back as adults. It was a complete failure. But that would be an example where the worry would be, had it worked, but not very well, it may have finished off what they were trying to save. And so that's sort of where that whole issue lies.
Yeah. We have to reinvent our relationship with the landscape. What would be some of the best ways in beginning to deal with that, beginning to make that change a reality?
Well, in regard to salmon in particular, a lot of the earliest salmon production in the Northwest, at least, and I think this would apply also to the Northeast and to England, but the evidence is harder to put together because the changes occurred so long ago, is that the big valley bottoms, essentially floodplains, were areas that were refugia for the fish during high flows. Like, if you're a little fish and you're in a big river and the flow comes up, you can't hold your position. You can be swept right out to the ocean. So what do? You go to the banks, you follow the floodwaters up onto the valley bottom, and then when the waters recede, you sort of slide back into the river. Those valley bottoms are in great part cut off from rivers now. We've isolated rivers, diked them. We don't let them move around. They can't create the kind of habitat salmon used to actually thrive in and live in.
We've subsidized home ownership in floodplains.
And yet, the human use of many of those same places is subsidized because it costs a lot to do things there because it floods all the time. Whether in terms of levee maintenance, flood control, rebuilding, we spend millions of dollars every year rebuilding things that were damaged in emergencies that are perfectly predictable because they recur every couple of years. So I think a huge opportunity lies in reconceiving how we use floodplains. If we reduced subsidies for the uses of floodplains and started to recover big pieces of them for the use of species like salmon, we could actually have a lot of people and a lot of fish in the region, and perhaps, and probably, I think, come out ahead economically because we'd be making more fish, so we'd have commercial fisheries, and we wouldn't be spending a lot of public dollars, or as many public dollars, on subsidizing human activity in places where nature doesn't really support that activity.
Yeah. One of your suggestions in improving wild salmon species survival and habitat is a system of river keepers. They have this on the Hudson River. A Puget Sound keeper, we know about it around here. Tell us about how that would work.
Yeah, well, I think there's different models for how it could work, but the idea is to essentially have someone in a position to argue for the resource, to essentially look out and balance other interests. That, because it was one of the long-term impacts, I think, on salmon runs in many places, are that the changes occur sort of piece by piece as decisions are made and compromises are made that eventually compromise away the landscape and the environment that the salmon were using. How do you counterbalance that? Well, it's got to be somebody's job to make the argument and push back a little bit to represent the fish, which is not to say that you'd have, you know, sort of police out there protecting every single fish from anybody ever doing anything to them, but it is to argue that it should be somebody's responsibility to look out for them, to make the arguments that need to be made, to push back a little bit when it needs to be, and to give when one needs to give for a good compromise. But so essentially I'm arguing that it needs to be the salmon need to be in somebody's care, because realistically they're in all of our care. But if no one is standing in the line of fire doing it, then we're all letting that responsibility slide.
Yeah. You say early in the book that treaties signed with the native tribes in the mid-1800s implied that the government had a responsibility to preserve salmon runs through habitat protection and land use restrictions if necessary. Can legal action by the tribes, as in the Bolt decision, be the glimmer of hope for wild salmon survival?
I think it could be. It'd be a very big stick to have in the arsenal. The legal precedents for that, for the habitat question, are still unsettled. And I think there's a great reluctance to actually force the issue, perhaps on all sides, because it's uncertain really how it'll play out. As I read the treaties, as a scientist, the logical thing to conclude is that there's an obligation to actually protect salmon runs to a level that Native Americans could essentially viably fish them. That obligation, while not explicit in the treaties, sure seems pretty clear when you read them.
That's a billion-dollar lawsuit, isn't it?
It's perhaps an underestimate, yes.
Is that right? Multi-billion-dollar settlement.
Oh, wait, the...
Or the ramifications of such a lawsuit could go into the billions of dollars.
That would be huge. That would be huge, yeah.
Yeah, all the money we haven't been spending all these years. It's a great book. You've really done your homework. This is your first book, isn't it?
It's my first book for a general audience. Yeah, I've edited a few for technical audiences. It was a lot of fun to write because it's in scientific writing, it's almost taboo to have fun with words. And I really enjoyed writing this. It was salmon are a wonderful animal. It's a labor of love.
Well, you know, if your scientific writing has phrases like topographical
impetus.
Yeah, then it can't be all bad. It's a great book for anyone interested in salmon and the history of it. It's very, very well done. Continued success with your writing.
Great. Thank you very much.
David Montgomery has been our guest. He is a professor of geomorphology at the University of Washington, and the book is King of Fish, The Thousand-Year Run of Salmon.